Hello, and welcome to the Offspring Magazine podcast. I'm Yuli, and I will be hosting this episode. This is part three of my series on black holes. While the first two episodes of the series focused on the observations of black holes via gravitational waves, the next two episodes will focus on observations of light coming from the surroundings of black holes. In this episode, Gunther Witzel from the MPI for Radio Astronomy in Bonn explains how it was possible to produce an image of the immediate surroundings of two supermassive black holes, the one at the center of the galaxy M87 and Sagittarius A star, which is the black hole at the center of our own galaxy, the Milky Way. The image of M87 became famous all around the world when it was published in 2019 by the Event Horizon Telescope Collaboration. If you don't know what I'm talking about, just quickly type black hole into Google image search. An image of what I like to call the orange donut will for sure be among the first few hits. The image was shown across the globe in newspapers, talk shows, and social media, and rightly so, because producing these images was a major scientific achievement. In this episode, Gunther describes the tremendous efforts in technological development, coordination and calibration between many different instruments, and data analysis that finally resulted in these famous and beautiful images. So stick around and enjoy this episode. I'm here at the Max Planck Institute for Radio Astronomy with Gunther Witzel. Thank you for joining this podcast.
My pleasure.
Could you start by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, of course. So my name is Gunther Witzel. I'm an astronomer here at the Max Planck Institute for Radio Astronomy in Bonn. I am working in the VLBI group. That's a group for a very long baseline interferometry. And I'm a member of the Event Horizon Telescope Collaboration. I have a special interest in black holes, and I'm working on the topic of the center of our own galaxy, mainly since my PhD. I did my PhD here in Cologne and went for a postdoc and for a few more years then to the University of California in Los Angeles, to the Galactic Center Group there, working with the Keck telescopes. Then returned here to Germany, and now I'm working in a slightly different wavelength regime, radio astronomy, but I still have also a strong connection still to the near-infrared community, and try to bring together the science from the different wavelength regimes and perspectives.
Nice. Okay, yeah, so we're here to talk about the Event Horizon Telescope collaboration, and especially the images that they produced of very first images of a black hole, or to say the Event Horizon itself. So maybe we should start by explaining what the Event Horizon actually is.
It's called Event Horizon Telescope Collaboration because we come very close to the Event Horizon. I think I will explain a little bit more why we don't directly image the Event Horizon. But we come very close to it. So it's a telescope that can access event horizon scales. That is the meaning, basically, of why Event Horizon shows up in the name of the collaboration. The Event Horizon is for a compact object is a boundary beyond which nothing that happens inside that boundary can influence an observer at infinity. So in more simple terms, it is a boundary where the escape velocity around the black hole becomes the speed of light, and as a result, once a photon has crossed the event horizon, it cannot escape anymore. And so this is a fundamental limitation for an observer. it is a prediction for a black hole. It is a radius at which potentially interesting things can happen, and it would be one of the most interesting discoveries, if we could really show evidence that this event horizon exists and that our physics there happens in the way we imagine it, or in the better case, if we could discover things that are not predicted. So it is one of the holy grails, basically, of black hole science to learn about what happens close to the event horizon. The Event Horizon Telescope now is the first instrument that has reached resolutions and capabilities to come close to the scale of the event horizon of two prominent black holes. So there are exactly two sources, interestingly, for which we can actually reach the necessary resolution, and we can talk a little bit more about why we exactly have selected these two sources. Now it is very important to make the distinction that we have not imaged the event horizon.
Okay. Right?
But we have imaged a region close to the event horizon where we can see the interaction of the black hole with its surroundings. And we can probe if predictions about these interactions, especially about the field of photons around the black hole, are accurate or not. And with that, we can already learn a lot about black holes. But we have not, in the closest sense, imaged an event horizon.
Okay. But you have come closest to the event horizon so far. So like before that, no one had imaged the region as close to the event horizon as you have now.
Right. So if you say imaged, that is exactly correct. There are other experiments that can reach similar scales with more abstract quantities and on the other hand, very precise measurements. For example, within the Max Planck Society, the Galactic Center Group in Munich at the MPE has developed an interferometer in the infrared gravity, and they can make very precise astrometric measurements, so they can very precisely measure distances. And also with a precision that was correspond to these event horizon scales. So they can also make statements about this regime, if you want so. However, the Event Horizon Telescope is an instrument that is supposed to produce an image. So an image is for us somehow something more concrete, right, than an abstract measurement, which explains also why people were so excited about it, I think. It is the only instrument with this capability. Now, one has to, of course, ask, how does it achieve this? Is it really an image in the classical sense, as we imagine it, basically a CCD behind a telescope? And we have to say, no, that is not the case. So it's more complicated. And also there is, if you want so, the necessity to fill in some blanks, so it's a little bit more abstract than a direct image, and that is a reason why it is actually so difficult to make these kind of images, and why it took quite a time even after taking the data to publish these results.
But as what you say, I think it's really nice or true, to have this actual image. I mean, that's also then it went through all newspapers and social media and everywhere. It's just like, something you can like look at and grasp.
Right.
And,
yes. You know. I mean, we have a saying in German, we say an image says more than 1,000 words. And I think this is exactly capturing this. Some people also sometimes say that the eyes are the sense with the highest data rate into our brain, basically, right? It has a large bandwidth, and we typically imagining things visually, right? Try to visualize things, and then if we have an image or something that can result in an image, it is somehow more suggestive for how we think about that physical object that we would like to investigate. So it's certainly a great help. At the same time, one has to also clearly state it is not a very precise measurement. So it's not a priori clear what kind of information you can infer from such an image. You can a lot of information, but it takes more effort, yeah, to interpret this actually,
Ja.
than for example the high precision orbit measurements of orbiting stars around the black hole,
Ja.
which also has been done at the Galactic Center, right?
Ja.
Yeah. The high precision measurement of a physical system, which we understand very, very clearly, and where we
Ja.
can very
Ja.
clearly deduce certain quantities from, right? Yeah.
Ja. Okay, but so this image, so I don't know, let's call it the famous orange
The
donut.
orange donut,
This is the image we all saw when it was published, but that's not what it looks like in reality. It's not shining in orange, right?
right. I mean, sure, the colors have been chosen artificially, but yeah. So yeah,
So
don't take the orange as something to interpret it
yeah,
physically. Yes.
so the observations were actually done in radio waves.
That's right. In
Yeah.
radio waves, so far at 1.3 millimeter wavelengths, we try to now open up the submillimeter wavelength regime, which would reward us with higher resolution and some other advantages. Yeah, so it's a radio image, and the reason for that is that interferometry, that is the tool with which we can reach these really insane resolutions. Interferometry is something that that we can do on this scale and in this way only in the radio regime.
Yeah, so maybe let's dig into interferometry a little bit. What does it mean? Like what basically, yeah, what is interferometry physically, and then how do you do it?
So in astronomy, what you always would like to do is build larger telescopes. So the reason is that you need high resolution. The larger your telescope, the more details you can actually discern in an object. But on the other side, you also would like to collect a lot of photons. So you would like to have a large collecting area to be as sensitive as possible. So these are the two aspects you typically try to optimize. And there are physical limitations on how large a radio dish can be. And one of the most shining examples, or most extreme examples, we have here in the Eifel in close to Bonn, the 100 meter telescope, which is fully steerable and is really a fantastic achievement that we could build. And it just became 50 years old, so we have it for 50 years and has been continuously further developed. So it's an absolute top instrument. However, you cannot reach resolutions necessary for example, imaging something close to the event horizon. So what do you do? And there's another technology that also has been developed in principle almost from the very beginning since this institute exists. It's called very long baseline interferometry. And the idea is that you use telescopes all over the world, record data about the same spot in the sky, and then actually go through a mathematical process that's called correlation to combine this data in a suited way to simulate a telescope that can be then as large as the Earth, basically as the diameter of the Earth. It's the biggest distance. It's a what you would call a sparse aperture. So we have then an aperture basically as the Earth, but you're just measuring the light coming in from an object is at certain points within this aperture,
Could you imagine that, like,
right?
like having a pixelated camera, but then like with a certain area, but then only pixels at certain places?
Not quite, because that is already in the image domain, what you describe,
Yeah.
which happens on the detector. Whereas what we now say is that we actually really record the amplitude and phase of the incoming electromagnetic waves at different places in the aperture. So it is
Okay.
as if you would have a mask in your aperture of your camera, yeah,
Okay.
where you have little pinholes in it. Yeah, so several pinholes. That would be the equivalent.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
So then it is so this correlation, so you literally like observe this this like the same radio wave with different telescopes around Earth. So how does is that really what
Right,
it
so
is?
what the whole procedure is called is aperture synthesis, right? So you combine then the signal of different telescopes, which are different points in your aperture. And what you do is you record the incoming signal. You do that with a high precision in time, so you have to have a atomic clock at each side. And you really record phase and amplitude of the electromagnetic wave at each station. And then what you can do is afterwards go to a computer, to a supercomputer, and actually correlate these signals. So each of these are time series in voltage, basically, literally, and it's very noisy. And there's in this noise a small, typically a factor 100 smaller. A noise signal itself that comes from the source of interest. So what we call a signal in this context is itself also a noise process. But this noise process has the property that it has, shows correlations with other sites in the aperture, if you want so. And now you can correlate these signals, and can from there deduce the values that we call, or the quantities that we call visibilities. Visibilities are complex numbers in the Fourier space of your image. And so for each combination of telescopes in your aperture, which we call a baseline, you get one point in the so-called UV space, which is the Fourier transform of your image. But since you have only a limited number of points in the aperture, you will not have a very good UV coverage. So for if you take an image, that UV coverage is perfect, right, with a camera, right? But for us, we actually have only sparse UV coverage, right? So we have a few points only. And so what we have to now do is Fourier transform that to receive an image.
Maybe quickly, some people might not know what a Fourier transform is. Let me just probably first explain
Okay, good. We
that.
can go back to that. But you do a transformation into the image domain, and since this UV plane is not fully filled with measurements, we have lost information, right? And now is the question: what is the best way to restore this information to actually receive an image that is still correct, right? That is true, where we didn't make up structure or something like that. And so that is the most important or difficult aspect, that you have a sparse measurement, you have not all the information to really restore an image, and you have to find good intelligent ways to still derive what is structure that you're confident in, that you can actually say, from these few measurements, I can still say, yes, it's, for example, a ring, or it is, a jet-like linear structure, or something like that. So there's a post-processing, very involved post-processing part in this whole analysis.
Okay, so let's quickly maybe go into the Fourier transform. What is it?
Well, it's a representation of your image, but in terms of a spatial frequency content, if you want so, right? So you can imagine that extended large structures, they don't need a signal at very fast spatial frequencies, and you can basically build up or represent any kind of image structure in terms of sinusoidal signals of a certain frequency, and their superposition. And so it's a mathematical representation that is entirely equivalent to the image plane, but is a little bit hard, to intuitively grasp,
Okay, so it's basically, I don't know if you had an image, I don't know, let's say of a mountain range, and you would take, a slice or like a little measurement every kilometer, then this in the frequency that would be this would be the frequency every kilometer.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the spatial frequency, exactly. The distance, basically,
The distance between the measurements, and then you do another measurements where you measure every 50 meters, and then that's another representation in the frequency range with the smaller frequency of the spatial measurements.
Exactly, if you want to. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then that also gives you an idea, if you only measure every kilometer of this mountain range, you get a rough image of what is going on. But if you measure every 50 meters, you will see smaller structures.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is...
Basically, that is what the Fourier domain is representing. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then that means in this, when you measure these very small structures, so very close to the event horizon, that means you have a very small spatial frequency, or like high spatial frequency coverage.
Yeah, so the more resolution you would like to have, the higher the spatial frequencies that you can that you should be still able to represent in your measurement are, right?
Okay.
So and the high frequencies now in Fourier space, they correspond to very long baselines in your aperture.
Okay.
So the longest baseline within your array of telescopes is defining what kind of resolution you can achieve.
Okay. And then...
At a given wavelength.
Okay. Okay. And then if you have several different baselines, they represent different frequencies, so that way you...
Right. And there's, of course, the two-dimensional aspect.
Yeah.
So you would like to have, of course, resolution in more than one direction.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an interesting a point already, and that is that we use Earth rotation to fill in this UV space, as we call it, right? To have more baselines. Because one set of baselines between the telescopes at a given moment is different from then one an hour later when Earth has rotated, right? And so if you let during your experiment Earth rotate, and then you can fill up your UV space and you get more information about the structure on the sky, both because in projection, because of Earth rotation, the baselines actually become differently long, right? In its projection to the source, but also because they change their orientation.
Yeah. It's a very fascinating, and I think the word collaboration really comes into play there. So you really had to coordinate these observations for all these, how many telescopes were involved?
In this first experiment, 8 sites.
8 sites all around the world.
All around the world, yeah, from the South Pole to Europe. Yeah.
Yeah. But then these are all like their own observatories.
Exactly. So, I didn't have to actually forge this collaboration. That is actually the achievement of the collaboration, and some key figures inside the collaboration. Here in Bonn, certainly Anton Sensus did a lot of work in this respect, and that is one of the most challenging aspects to bring all these sites together, to understand their respective time allocation methods, and to make sure that the necessary equipment is at each site. And then, there are telescopes that of vastly different sizes and with different noise properties and so on. So it's a very inhomogeneous data set, if you want, so to make that as homogeneous as possible. And then to actually do the data reduction, that's a profound problem,
yeah.
If you want so. However, that is the problem that if you want so, plagued VLBI from the very beginning. I mean, there are, of course, also interferometers that are built at a given site. For example, ALMA or something, some telescope like ALMA, where they made sure that all the antennas are very comparable, and you can reach with minimal effort a good UV coverage and so on. So interferometers in other contexts exist and are more uniform and are actually the modern class of radio telescopes. But if you would like to do it on this global scale, then you are typically ending up with very different observatories. And so that was a basic problem of VLBI from the very beginning, and people found solutions for all these problems. So that is maybe something that one can not state enough, that this technology has been developed over 40 years, and that there were really pioneers from the first moment who found solutions to all these problems at the time still at centimeter wavelengths, right? And with time we have progressed more and more to shorter wavelengths, to larger bandwidths, and it's a real achievement of civilization, if you want so, and of science, global science, that this was done, kept alive with a clear view that this is a an effort worthwhile, with very interesting results on the way, but maybe not as spectacular, and especially not with the same media coverage as the EHT results now. And then, you know, at the end of 40 years, you have like really one of these outstanding results that come out of this technology. And that is a typical commitment for which you need something like the Max Planck Society, right?
Yeah.
That actually says, yes, we do this, we provide the infrastructure, we will, you know, further develop it until the technology is so mature that you can do truly outstanding things.
Yeah, that's really incredible. All of this work that went into this and this commitment. Yeah, you're right. And maybe we could quickly mention a little bit what actually your group here at the Institute is working on.
Yeah, our group is the Department for Very Long Baseline Interferometry at the Max Planck Institute for Radio Astronomy. And the very technology that we just discussed has been in parts developed here, right? Both from the technology side, but also from the scientific side, understanding what are the interesting and suited targets, for example, also for the EHT. We also have a correlator here in-house. That means one of the two supercomputers in the world who can actually process EHT data is here. The other one is at the Haystack Observatory of the MIT in the US. And also there, basically, we are very competitive here and we play at the forefront of this experiment. And then, of course, image reconstruction, interpretation, and all of this in parts also happens here in-house, typically organized in the working groups of the EHT together with our colleagues all over the world. This is one of the central groups, and the basically raw data wouldn't exist without this institution.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. So that's really an important location and group here in Bonn for all this.
And one can also say that the 100-meter telescope that can operate down to 3 millimeters has been also very instrumental in the preparations, both the development of millimeter VLBI over the many years, but also in precursor observations of, for example, such as our M87. There is a VLBI network which is called GMVA, a Global Millimeter VLBI Array, and that is something organized here from Bonn, and where FSBAC plays a key role. But then for the EHT measurements themselves, like at 1.3 millimeters, and now for the future 0.8 millimeters, FSBAC cannot participate. It just doesn't have the necessary accuracy. But then other telescopes that are associated to the Institute are participating, and that is on one side APEX in the Atacama Desert, also in Chile. Submillimeter telescope, as well as Pico Vileta by URAM, a partner organization, together with France. This observatory is operated in Spain at the Pico Vileta. And then also another interferometer, NOEMA, plays a role that is operated also by URAM in France. And all these observatories are associated with the telescope, with the institute here, and in parts we provide technological support in other aspects. So.
Okay. You mentioned all these different noises that all different telescopes and observatories have different noise and so on. So what are these sources of noise in your data?
As I said, in principle, if you look at your time series at every given moment, what you call the signal is really just a tiny contribution. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So only in the correlation, process and in the integration over time, you basically can tickle out this signal. What we call a signal here is not the signal of, let's say, a radio program or something, right? It's a noise process in itself, yeah? But mm-hmm. it has the property to show these correlations, right? That is the important difference. The other contributions that are not correlated and are actually not really carrying any information for you, they are, for example, thermal noise of your receivers, of your telescopes. There are other contributors. I mean, the atmosphere is certainly one contributor. Also, the cosmic microwave background is mm-hmm. Already at this level contributing. And then you need to look at other effects which are not really noise-like, but are effects that you have to take into account, right? One of which is the tidal deformation of Earth by the moon, right? Mm-hmm. Because you need to know very precisely where telescopes are relative to each other. And also that is an effect big enough to basically disturb our signal or our measurement. So a hierarchy basically of different effects that have to be taken care of by the correlation process itself or by the preparation of the data before correlation.
Yeah. So how precisely do you really need to know the position of the telescope? So the baselines are thousands of kilometers?
Yeah, the longest baseline here is, I think, something like 8.6 giga lambda. So one measures it in the wavelength, right?
Okay.
And we are at 1.3 millimeter, that means somewhat slightly above 11,000 kilometers. That's the longest baseline
that
has been used for the 2017 experiment. So these are enormous distances. You need to know that the quantity that tells you how exact you have to know distances is the wavelength, right? We need to know down to a millimeter. Yeah.
Wow. So on a scale of 11,000 kilometers, you cannot be more wrong, like a millimeter scale. That's precision measurements right there.
Very high precision.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe let's start talking a little bit more about the images themselves, not mm-hmm. as much of how you got to them. So the first one that was published and went around the world was the image of M87, the black hole at the center of M87. So maybe first of all, what is M87? What kind of source?
Oh, yeah. So M87 is another galaxy. It's an extra galactic source. And it's a very prominent source because it shows very bright jets that were actually known as linear features in the sky before we knew even that it's a different galaxy, before we had a clear idea that our mm-hmm. universe is not only composed by the Milky Way, but that actually there is an extra galactic universe, right? So M87 is about 2,000 times further away than the center of our galaxy, and it is luckily about 2,000 times heavier, or has 2,000 times more mass mm-hmm. than the black hole in our own galaxy. But the scale is now something that scales with mass and distance, right? So actually inversely with distance and proportional to mass.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that is 2,000 times, has 2,000 times more mass, but is 2,000 times further away, looks in the sky, the same size as our galactic center black hole. About, right? I mean, mm-hmm. it's rather rough numbers. More or less. And that means these are the two black holes that appear in the sky with more or less the same scale. And it's just a scale that we can now achieve at a millimeter wavelength, or at low millimeter VBI.
Okay. So there's like no other black hole as of that size in our sky right now. So that's how you chose M87.
Right. So we're talking about supermassive black holes, right? Millions to billions of solar masses. Mm-hmm. And so these are the two objects where mass and distance just cooperate.
Yeah.
If you want, so nicely that we can resolve event horizon scales.
Okay. Yeah.
And just to give you an idea, the event horizon scale that we would like to resolve, the angular scale is 10 microarcseconds for such a star for the galactic center black hole. Yeah.
What is a microarcsecond for those who are not astronomers?
Right. So an arcsecond is the 60th of a 60th of a degree, and a micro is 10 to the minus 6. Yeah. So we're talking about 10 to the minus 6 times 1 over 3,600, right, of a degree. So it's a very, very tiny distance in the sky, right? Angular distance.
Yeah.
And so this is the quantity with which we measure resolution, arcseconds, milliarcseconds, microarcseconds now. And 10 microarcseconds is the Schwarzschild radius, so-called. So that would be the radius of the event horizon for a non-rotating Schwarzschild black hole. Right?
So, okay. So I think there were like the collaboration when they were doing press releases and so on. I think they always had these comparisons of the resolution is comparable to being able to see a euro coin on the moon.
Yeah, things like that, or to discern bubbles in your soda in New York.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are many of these comparisons.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary. Yes. Right? It's beyond imagination, actually.
Okay, so then, you already started mentioning Schwarzschild radius and rotation and so on. So let's talk about what you learned about the black hole from the image and the properties of the black hole.
Yeah. So first of all, these two images have been published with more than 2 years distance. So the question is, why did it happen like this, right? so M87, because it's such a giant, is luckily an object that doesn't change quickly. So also here, the time scales of changes in the structure are related to the mass. The larger you are, the slower actually things change. No? At this point, I might have to maybe mention what we are actually observing, because up to now we just talked about black holes and event horizons, and that we're not imaging really the event horizon, and that it's particularly the place where light disappears and can actually not return to us. So that means, of course, that you can't directly observe it. You can only observe a black hole indirectly in its interaction with its surrounding. And so that can work, for example, by looking at stars that orbit the black hole in the center of our galaxies and measuring their orbits and inferring from there what is the mass of that central object. But one can also infer properties of the black hole through its interactions with photons. So that is a prediction of general relativity, that not only mass around the black hole reacts to the gravitational fields, but also photons do.
Mm-hmm.
And that is exactly something that we use here. So we're looking at black holes that are situated in the hearts of galaxies with a lot of stars and gas and other objects that emit photons, and so you are embedded in this field of photons, now this black hole starts interacting with it, and particularly it will force photons on curved trajectories, it works in principle like a lens on anything behind the black hole that emits photons, like an optical lens. And so this kind of gravitational lens is something that distorts, if you want, so this photon field. And these distortions is something that we can see, for example, in this ring structure.
Okay.
And it also leads, the event horizon itself leads to a depletion of photon in the center. Of this kind of structure, right? So we have what we call the shadow, that is a lack of photons due to the fact that photons are, caught by the black hole. So, so it's an indirect measurement. That's the important thing, right? What we see is are photons emitted by other matter around the black hole. We see potentially even the matter that is accreted onto the black hole and maybe forms out a disk. We see potentially jets that are emitted at the axis of these black holes, and synchrotron radiation or whatever, which is emitted there. We don't see the black hole itself, only its interaction with these photons.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just quickly want to dial in.
Yeah.
We in previous podcast episodes, we were talking about curvature of space-time and how it affects. I just want to, for those who are maybe, this was a bit quick, clarify. So the light is curved because it travels on these lines in space-time, and they are so strongly affected by the gravitation of the black hole that the trajectories of the light are affected by the black hole, and this is how you get this lensing effect.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. That is correct.
Yeah. So now we wanted to discuss what we actually learned. So what were the results basically of all of this?
Yeah. M87 now is a black hole with a large mass, and as a result, the structure of the matter around the black hole, that is the origin of the photons with which we make these measurements, is not changing so fast as, for example, in the case of such a star, right? Which is 2,000 times, has a mass 2,000 times lower than M87. As I said before, we use Earth rotation to fill in the UV plane. So if you really would like to make an image, you need as many points in the UV plane as possible. And during the time scale of Earth rotation, such a star actually changes, whereas M87 doesn't. And it's a requirement, basically, for the image reconstruction that the object that you scan in this way, right, is not changing during your scan. Right? And that made it so much harder to actually observe or derive an image for such a star than for M87. Now, what do we see here, right? So we have a ring structure, we have a central, if you want, so obscuration, something that people call now as a black hole shadow. And indeed, the black hole shadow, if you would like so, is the direct effect of the event horizon, right? It is indeed photons that are fished away by the black hole from this surrounding photon field, photons that can't reach us anymore. Whereas this ring structure is a depiction if you want to, the matter that surrounds the black hole through this gravitational lens. What it exactly is that we see there that emits is not clear. Is there an accretion disk around the black hole? Are there jets? Where do these photons originally come from? That is something that we cannot derive from these images directly, at least not yet. And so many constellations of how we think matter might organize itself around the black hole will lead to very similar images. but the really important aspect here is the presence of this depletion of photons in the center, and the scale that is set by this. So you can now go and basically try to measure what is the size of the shadow. There's a certain degree of inaccuracy in it because the ring has a finite size, and you don't know exactly where is the transition. What do you call basically ring? What is the shadow? But a scale is set by this shadow, and this scale now has been shown to directly relate to black hole properties, especially the mass, of course, pretty much independent of other black hole parameters. So it is very informative, but other than really informing about the mass, the most important thing is that actually this kind of structure has been observed, because this is a long-standing prediction how the direct surrounding of a black hole should look if we are able actually to access these scales. And the first predictions of this kind have been made by Jean-Pierre Lumine in 1979. At the time, it was really an amazing achievement to do the calculations and then from there derive a picture. It was by far not as simple as today, and it is highly accurate if you compare it to the predictions nowadays. And then there were later on, around the year 2000, prediction by Heine Falke on how actually VLBI is a suited tool to really access these scales.
Yeah. Okay.
And yeah, so the first order result is we see this kind of structure, right?
Yeah.
And the second order results are derivations about the nature of the object.
Okay. Mm. So, but then that means that you are comparing the image that you produce with your measurements to theoretical images that you produce,
yes,
from calculations and simulations.
That's right. Yeah. So starting with, you know, qualitative expectations down to very, very quantitative comparisons.
Mm-hmm.
That have to do with GRMHD simulations that really show how matter would organize itself in an accretion disk, for example, and with or without the presence of jets, and what the structure then in precisely would be, yeah,
yeah,
and the scales. Yeah.
GRMHD, General Relativity Magnetohydrodynamic Simulations.
That is correct.
Okay. Okay, and then I'm assuming that then you also then, you know, make some assumptions and produce the simulated image, and then, yeah, through this comparison really constrain certain models or make like,
yes, so to some degree that was done. It is very difficult for certain parameters to constrain them with such an image of this quality, and other parameters are better constrained. You know, of course, mass is an example. But here is, I think, the most interesting difference between M87 and ZJSTAR. So M87 was the first image, and it showed, yes, this kind of structure exists.
Mm-hmm.
But now you could actually be devil's advocate and say, well, maybe it is not really caused, this kind of structure, by the black hole in the center of it. Ring kind structures might occur in other context, or maybe it's a coincidence of a certain way that you see a ring like structure, and indeed the scales that we then get by measuring the shadow or something are not informative about the black hole. It was not very likely, especially because there were already two mass estimates from previous studies,
mm-hmm,
from gas dynamics and other studies and one of these mass constraints was, you know, spot on with the scale that we observed.
Okay.
Yeah. So there was already a hint that it's most likely not like this, but we could not, go back to a reliable previous mass estimation.
Mm-hmm.
That's very different for the galactic center, because the Garching group, the galactic center group around Reinhard Genzel, who received the Nobel Prize together with Andrea Ghez,
mm-hmm,
for this work, because they have measured the precise orbits of stars orbiting the galactic center, they could derive the mass very precisely. And nowadays, the precision of these measurements is really incredible. It's less than 0.1%,
mm-hmm,
precision. I think almost nobody who listens to us can actually tell his own weight or the weight on any object around them with this precision,
mm-hmm,
you know, and we can do that actually about a black hole that is 20,000 light years away. That's really mind blowing. So we have a very, very precise idea of what the mass of this black hole should be. So we can derive now theoretically what is the scale that we expect. What is the Schwarzschild radius, and what is especially the radius of the shadow that is related to the Schwarzschild radius but larger? It's a factor of 5.2 is the diameter larger than the Schwarzschild radius. So
okay,
that also tells you, you know, we're not imaging the event horizon,
mm-hmm,
but more indirect structure, you know,
mm-hmm,
that has to do with the event horizon,
yeah,
but it's not, you know,
yeah, mm-hmm.
And So we have a precise prediction, and this precise prediction now was confirmed by the observations of the EHD, right?
Okay.
So now I think we have much more evidence really to believe strongly that the structure that we see is directly related to the black hole and actually dominated by the space-time of the black hole.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned with Sagittarius A star at the center of our Milky Way, there are these difficulties with the fact that it's actually variable on the scales that you observe it. So how did you deal with this variation? How did you correct for it?
Yeah, first of all, you have to monitor it with other telescopes as well, respectively take a single site data and try to find out how variable was it. Right? And we could actually see that there was one night where it was, or one epoch where it was very variable. And that's not your prime data set, right?
Yeah.
So you try to use the ones where the variability is more moderate. That's exactly what happened. And yes, so then you have to find certain, if you want, so averaging processes that has to try to deduce the commonality between all the different moments and data sets independent of these variations. And there have been different proposals how to do this. Indeed, we had several pipelines that were trying to deal with this problem, and then all of them have produced images, and they have not only produced one image, but actually a large number of images that are consistent with the data. Yeah. And then you look through this large library of possible solutions, you know, and find that there are, you know, structures that look alike, and you could actually, that's what was found out, that we could categorize all possible images in four categories.
Okay.
And three of these categories look very alike, actually. They all have this ring structure. There might be a little bit different, you know, distribution of flux along the ring and so on, but they're all very similar. And there's one that could still be seen as consistent with a ring, but looks a little bit more elongated and is maybe not as clear as a case, but that is also the one with the smallest fractions of examples in this library, right, of images that that are in agreement with the data. So that is a way, basically. It's kind of a statistical approach. You have to now give more or less the most probable common structure for your data set. So also in this respect, it's a little bit more abstract of an image, you know, than just taking a photo, if you want. So, yeah. And then it's a question, of course, how to improve it in the future, right? And how to become more complete in measurements that take a shorter time, right? That would be an ideal to actually overcome this problem. The other solution comes more from the simulation direction, where you actually try to really simulate how the black hole also behaves on shorter time scales, and then to use this kind of information to then not derive an image, but maybe a movie from the data. Yeah.
Right.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
So just to make sure that I understood this correctly, so you have the possible solutions that are all compatible with the data, and this is because your data is sparsely sampled. So basically, all of these possible solutions could produce the few dots,
right,
that you actually measured.
Exactly, and on top of it, you know that different data points have been taken at different times, so there is this aspect of the variability. In it, that
okay.
You know, that not only is it sparse information, but at times you might have to disregard certain information because it's just representing something that happened at that moment, and it's not representative for other moments.
So. Okay. And you mentioned that so you took measurements with basically the same radio observatories that were like busy at the time, or like taking the VLBI data at the time to also monitor the variability.
And that's right. So ALMA, for example, has been used as a single station.
ALMA is
The Atacama Large Millimeter Array.
In Chile.
Chile, yeah. Exactly. It's an interferometer in itself. So it's an interesting case where you would like, you know, you have an interferometer, but you don't want to use it as an interferometer. You would like to use it as a single dish in the context of the larger array of the larger interferometer. And so for that, ALMA needed to be used in a certain way. It's called as a phased array. So you are there not interested anymore between the correlations and basically the time delays of the infalling signal. But you would like to use it as a large array just that collects photons, if you want so. And you would like to make it behave as a single dish, right? Mm-hmm. So all these time delays that lead to correlations in your ALMA interferometer, they are artificially taken out, right?
Mm-hmm.
To make it just behave like one large collecting area that you can then use in the context of the larger array. You can still, in post-processing, reverse this process, right, and then still use it as an interferometer in its own right. Of course, with much lower resolution, but ALMA is highly sensitive, has a good resolution, and you can then derive, we call it light curves, that are the monitoring of the brightness over time,
mm-hmm.
From this one station, right?
Oh,
and
okay.
So that has been done in parallel, and then you have a clear idea. Basically, globally, if you don't resolve such a star in any way, it just looks like a point source to you. But what is the flux density at every given time? And it gives you an idea on how variable the source was and mm-hmm. how bright.
Okay, so that's cool. So you can basically like kill two pigs with one stone by, using the telescope array for the actual VLBI measurements, but then at the same time, via offline analysis, you have the monitoring data.
That's right, exactly.
That's cool. So you monitored with the radio telescopes that were doing the VLBI observations, but did you also monitor the source with observatories that observe at other wavelengths?
Yes, we did. So this is a large collaboration and a large effort, and you try to actually complement it with as much other information as you can. And so we observe in parallel, for example, with X-ray observatories, Chandra, or also infrared observatories, and try to use this additional information to piece together a more complete picture. Now, at these longer wavelengths, at these higher frequencies, shorter wavelengths, infrared and X-ray, we know that the source is much more variable, the emission processes are not fully understood yet. We also don't know exactly how it relates to the submillimeter, where 1.3 millimeter and submillimeter regime where the EHD operates. But we anyway take this data because at some point in the future we might actually be able to understand this. So there's also a legacy character to this data set, that you have this fantastic interferometric data set that allows to resolve the source. And at the same time, we have then additional complementary data that once we are able to piece things better together, will give a more complex or more complete view also of this individual data set. Now, the interesting side products of these observations, and that is again concerning ALMA, because for this one day where we had an extraordinarily variable submillimeter a light curve, and that we didn't use for the image reconstruction, we actually found a signal in the polarization of the ALMA light curves. Now polarization is a property of the electromagnetic wave. It tells you the direction of the E field in the electromagnetic wave, and that can have a preferred direction, and that carries additional information about the emission processes, as well as about, for example, matter that lies between you and the object that you observe, that actually changes the polarization properties of the light on the way. But it also can give you information about space-time around the curved space-time around the black hole. So indeed, what has been observed was a so-called QU loop in this ALMA data set. So Q and U are parameters with which we characterize the polarization. They are so-called Stokes parameters. in the QU plane during the light curve, you can actually see how this polarization state describes a loop, and not only one large loop but also a small nested loop in it, inside it. And now this is exactly the prediction you would make for a hot compact region in the accretion flow, or a so-called hotspot moving around the black hole in the curved spacetime. And that was very exciting because an entirely unexpected result of the EHT campaign from an individual observatory, and that certainly complements the whole view of what happens in and around such a star, and that is something that you couldn't predict. So that is one of the reasons why you would like to take additional data with the EHT. To see, you never know what happens, right? There are always surprises, and this particular result confirms actually previous observations that have been done in the infrared with the gravity interferometer. So the Garching team around Reinhard Genzel, who in 2020 won the Nobel Prize, has not only observed the orbits of stars around the black hole, but also the exact position of the emission region around such a star during a phase of brighter variability. And that also describes a loop at the sky. And in parallel with it, in the polarization QU plane, also describe a similar loop to what I just described. And so this is really exciting. We have mounting evidence that these kind of compact regions, hotspots, or something similar in the accretion flow exists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really cool. I mean, such a really important and great result, just as a side product.
A side product, exactly. Yeah.
Nice. So you mentioned now that you also in the future want to keep observing and produce more EHT observations. So what are the more concrete plans for the next years or so?
There are several plans. So, I mean, these two sources are not the only sources observed with the EHT, but there are a number of other prominent sources that we also observe, not to resolve the event horizon scale of these objects, but to actually do millimeter VLBI observations of their jets and mm-hmm. Features in these prominent sources. And work is there ongoing. Also, the data reduction and so on has to be done. And so there's a whole, if you want, so industry of people working on these data sets and writing papers also. With respect to these two sources, M87 and Search A Star, there are now several next steps. And one is that we have, of course, observed other campaigns that have been now to be reduced or analyzed. And we do here now the step away from 1.3 millimeter to the sub-millimeter regime, 0.8 millimeters. The array will be completed, or now has been slightly changed, and then in the future might have get other stations in order to fill this UV plane and make actually reconstruction of the structure much easier, and also mm-hmm. the disentanglement from the temporal variability easier. So there are a lot of ideas. All the way up to the point that the idea is that a future EHT should potentially entirely operate in space, and you use certain satellite constellations to really get, you know, more or less full UV coverage, which is would be very, very exciting prospects. There are many developments. In order to go to the higher frequencies, you also need different receiver technology, ultimately the new what we call back ends. So these are recording devices that sit in the behind the receiver and can record these high bandwidths.
Mm-hmm.
That means if you go to a higher bandwidth that you become more sensitive. There might be even, you know, other aspects like some form from artificial intelligence implemented already in the receiver technology, so it can recognize if there's interference that is, you know, corrupting the signal, and And you just cut it out immediately before you even record it, so it will not be able to corrupt the scans that you're recording. So in all these levels, the technology moves forward, and it's in part developed here in-house in the Max Planck Institute for Radio Astronomy, and will lead to a gradual improvement of all these images. And then I think as a result, we will at some point know much better really what we're looking at in detail.
Nice. Yeah, I think we have covered a lot of things. So I think we can conclude this conversation here. Thank you so much for taking all the time and
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That's it. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode and that you will join me again next week. I'm not going to spoil too much about my next episode, only this much. If you listened carefully to this episode, you might already guess who my next guest is going to be. You should definitely tune in next week. It's going to be another great episode. If you like this podcast and don't want to miss out on new episodes, go ahead and hit subscribe and also check out our social media channels on Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Offspring Magazine, the podcast, is brought to you by the Max Planck PhDnet and the science communication working group known as the Offspring Magazine. The intro-outro music is composed by Srinath Rankumar, and the pre-intro jingle is composed by Gustavo Corizo. For any feedback, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to write us at offspringplotpodcast@phdnet.mpg.de. Until next week, stay safe, stay healthy. Bye-bye.